Before we begin, just giving you an update on our new subscription. It's called David McWilliams Plus on Apple. You just double click, you get no ads, and you get me and John, pure and simple.
And Mac, you get early access to episodes. Did you know that?
Sure, my day is made.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
Welcome to the podcast. We are here in St. Patrick's Church in Dalkey, and I am about to talk to Gary Steingart. This is a podcast we recorded at the Dalkey Book Festival. Steingart is one of my favourite novelists, described by The New Yorker as the finest satirist writing in the United States at the moment. Let's listen to Gary Steingart.
Ladies and gentlemen, Gary Steingart.
Thank you.
Gary, let's kick off, right? Born in Leningrad, 1972.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching Anthony Bourdain's food program, and they go to Brighton Beach, and yours truly stars in it. Okay,
yeah.
So Anthony Bourdain is trying to find the essence of Russians, Jewish life.
That's right.
And he finds it there.
Yeah.
So tell me, how do you end up there?
I don't know, it was one of his first episodes, and I guess they weren't being as adventurous. They weren't going to, you know, Vietnam or whatever yet. The budget didn't have it yet. So they said, you know, let's go to Brooklyn. We heard good things about it, just across the river. And let's find the real, like, small, furry, ethnic dude to take us around, and that'll add a lot of authenticity, you know. Maybe somebody who don't even speak English that good, you know. So, and who doesn't charge anything. Just wants to be on TV, you know, that's important. And they settled on me. And it's so weird. I see sometimes it appears on airplanes when I'm flying somewhere. And I really look kind of rotund, don't I?
And you're eating well.
I'm eating a lot. Yeah, maybe that's the thing. Yeah, I took him, what did we take him to? There was this delicious Ukrainian restaurant. I was already thinking ahead. I knew this was coming handy. Yeah, we took him to a Ukrainian restaurant with this delicious, stewed rabbit and sour cream and prune. Mmm, so good. Russians can't do stuff like that. That's definitely Ukrainian stuff. I think I took him to an Uzbek place for some plov, and then to a nightclub.
Yeah, you know, I remember the nightclub.
The nightclub was great, the National. I love these nightclubs. They're still around in Brighton Beach. It was, so you go, and as soon as you sit down, there's a carafe of vodka put on your table. So, and then it keeps getting replenished as you drink it. Everyone's supposed to drink one carafe per person. I think Bourdain was already not drinking at that point, because I drank his, I remember that. I was like,
How do you end up in Queens? The story, the backstory.
Well, the backstory is actually food related, because Russia, the Soviet Union in the 70s had a series of bad wheat harvests, and they desperately needed wheat and bread. And so they had a program that was unofficially titled Jews for Grain, where America, which has plenty of grain, would send millions of tons of grain, and Russia sent 100,000 Jews. So
In exchange.
So I was exchanged for a baguette or a croissant or something, which I don't know who got the better end of that deal. But It was incredible.
So you arrive in the States, what are you, 8 years old, 10 years old?
7 years old, yeah.
7 years old?
7 years old, yeah.
And what's that like?
It was horrifying. I mean, I didn't, I grew up in St. Petersburg, Leningrad, which is a very pretty town, kind of like Dalkey, but larger, and with fewer nice cars, I noticed. And then we moved to Rome for about a year as Soviet Jews were funneled through Rome at that point. So we had to live a year there. That was great. We loved Rome. The food, the people, all of that was great. And then we end up in Queens. And Queens is, I don't know if you've ever been to Queens. It's not great. There are problems. We were, you know, we thought this is what we emigrated to. And then I went to a Hebrew school, a Hebrew, like a religious yeshiva school. Sentenced to 8 years of religious school for a crime I did not commit. No offense to religion, hey, Protestantism, whatever this is.
Yeah, good stuff. Like...
yeah, but this was a very conservative school, and I was taught both Hebrew and English, because I didn't know either one, and those were the two languages of instruction. And that's when I began, I couldn't speak without an accent, but I began to write my first American satire, and it was really a Jewish satire called the Genora, which was the Torah, but with, I don't know, GNUs in it. And I wrote it on an actual scroll, and it would make fun of all the rabbis and things like that and in the school. And it made me my first American friends. So there was a kind of exchange of writing for being considered a part of the community before I was completely, I was the stinky Russian bear, they would call us, the Russians. They were not happy with us because we had all these big fur hats and my coat was made from some woodland animal, some elk or something. So writing was my entree into the world of not being beaten up all the time. That's what writing does. It worked for Joyce, right?
Yeah. It did work for Joyce.
He was beaten to a pulp before then. Yeah.
So you're there in Queens. What are these communities like? Because so much of your stuff, we're going to talk about the work, but yeah. So much of the work revolves around central characters who are displaced.
Displaced, yeah. So, and I grew up, I mean, almost all of my best friends and my wife too are either immigrants or children of immigrants from, well, not just from Russia, but from all parts of the world. But what's interesting, I think, is many people think that, you know, like they'll bundle all of South Asians together as one being, you know, whether you're Pakistani or Sri Lankan or Indian or the same for East Asian and et cetera. But also for those of us from the Slavic parts of the Soviet Union, we were all different too, as we now realize with this war. Obviously, Putin says that Ukraine is the same as Russia, but they are incredibly different. And Brighton Beach, which is what people associate with Russia, is originally, I would say, more of a Ukrainian, and to be more specific, an Odessa neighborhood. And in fact, its moniker is Little Odessa. And Odessa is awesome. It's just a great city. Oh, yeah, it's like, it's the most freewheeling, humorous city. It's almost the opposite of St. Petersburg, where I'm from, which is very snobby and stuck up and stuff like that. And so the Odessity in Russian, the Odessites, lived in Brighton Beach. And the Muscovites, Leningraders, and some people from Kiev also lived in the northern reaches of Queens. And even as a child, there was like, oh, God, those people in Brighton Beach are terrible, you know. Even though they spoke the same language, ate the same kielbasa, drank heavily, and still there was that, you know, well, they're not like us. We're the cultured people. So I remember going to Brighton Beach was, even for me, kind of like a safari, you know, going into a completely different place just because their accent was slightly different. They didn't pronounce the G the same way we pronounce the G. It had more of a sound. And for that, they were, you know, despised.
They were vilified.
Oh, those people. Oh, God. No, it's terrible. Don't marry a girl. Don't marry a girl. So even then, there was a lot of friction. But my parents wanted to be as far away from other Russians or Russian speakers as possible. So they moved into the house they own is the very last house in Queens. Beyond that is Tony Long Island. We're the last New Yorkers there.
Actually live, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, no. In fact, their backyard, I think, is sliced by the city border or something like that. So, you know, but it was miserable because I hated the school. I didn't learn anything. I, you know, until I was 15, I thought, you know, God created the earth in 7 days and dinosaurs were supposed to be like Thursday from 8 to 9 p.m. You know, that was the dinosaurs. And then I went, of all places, to a math and science high school where I had, after Hebrew school, no idea what the hell was going on, you know. Algorithms, what? You know, none of that. And it was a very tough school. And I wasn't very good at math or science, but I did discover Manhattan, which I'd never... We were too scared to go there. On the news, it said it was very violent over there. And in fact, there's like a couple, there's maybe three skyscrapers at the time in Queens. And growing up, I thought that was Manhattan, those three skyscrapers. So when I actually landed in the real place, I was shocked. And that's when I made my first really good American friends. And they were just like the characters in Our Country Friends. They were all from all over the world. I mean, the school, I think, specialized Korea, India, Russia. Those were all heavily represented, China as well. So that was the first place I felt at ease. You know, nobody made fun of me. We all were weirdos and first generation Americans. And we all spoke, you know, this crazy patois. And, you know, it was very heartwarming in a way after... Also, the school I went to in Queens was very wealthy, and this was, everyone's dad washed dishes at the local restaurant or something. So when it came time to write my sixth novel, I had already done so many books about my parents, good Lord, and about romantic entanglements, although there's a lot of sex in this too.
There is a lot of sex.
I can't not write sex, but oh God, it's better than bacon crisps. Yeah,
it's a lot better, yeah.
Well,
it would have been inappropriate in the sacristy, but you know.
Yes, now that we're out here.
For the, yeah.
Yes, and so, you know, I'd written about romantic entanglements, I'd written about parents, and now I kind of wanted to write about the immigrants of my generation as we hit 50, you know, which is this sort of, the Chekhovian time of regrets. What have I done? What have I not done?
But the characters, so it's like the Decameron, really. It's like in the pandemic,
I'm really bad with math.
Yeah.
Eight?
One, two, three, four, five, six,
nine.
There's various American villagers.
So
but it is like the Decameron. So these people go to this country house. The guy who runs the show is a Russian guy, Sedorovsky.
Yeah. I have no imagination, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So set the scene for us.
So Sasha Sidorovsky, who was modeled in part of my friend Sasha Sidorovich. In fact, I was going to call him Sasha Sidorovich, and he called me up. He's like, look, I'm up for tenure this year. Can you not do this? So I changed it to Sidorovsky. And this guy's like a dead ringer for me. We do sometimes this kind of thing, and it's like, who's who? You know, who's on first? And so he has a house in the country, and I also have a house in the country, but I have one little guest house. He has five of them. And the reason I did that is because when I was a kid growing up in Queens, we had, all Russians have a dacha, which is a small country house like one has in Dalkey, you know. Tiny little thing.
Two, by the way.
Two tiny little houses, only 800 meters each square. So, you know, he has, we would go to this Russian bungalow colony upstate New York, and there everybody was a Russian kid just like me, and it felt, those summers were the summers that I remember the best, my first love, my first friendships before high school, all of that kind of came together in that place. And so the idea of having little houses, and I still have my friends from the city up all the time. In America, you call it the Fresh Air Fund, which gets poor kids from the inner city, and I do that to my journalist and academic friends from Brooklyn and Queens. So Sasha does this to his friend, has all of his friends come up fleeing the pandemic in New York. Because I was up there in March when things began to close down, as they probably did here as well in March. And at this point, I was writing a very satirical novel, heavily satirical, which this is not. And it was, I already written like 240 pages of it. It was a novel set slightly in the future in which NYU, do you know New York University? It's a big...
Yeah.
NYU takes over Manhattan and builds like walls around it and has its own security force, the Violet Helmets. This makes sense if you know New York more, but it was supposed to be a satire of academia. I teach at Columbia, which is the competitor to NYU. God, we hate each other so much. And I thought, well, you know, worst comes to worst, I'll get a raise, you know, for writing this horrifying spoof of NYU. But then when the pandemic started, I realized immediately that this was a catastrophe, in part because obviously it's a catastrophe on a medical level, but also we had a certain president back then. And despite, you know, Dr. Bleach's effort to cure us of COVID, things didn't quite go as well. And that kind of double tragedy, the tragedy of a dictatorial political force and also things falling apart on a micro and macro level, reminded me a lot of the Soviet Union. And so I thought, which again had, you know, complete complete incompetence. So I decided to switch gears and start writing this, and I abandoned my satirical academic novel.
But is it still in...
You know, you pull it out I don't know, thing? Maybe, I don't know. Once I abandon something, it's hard to go back, because the energy, the spark is gone. And, I'm onto something else anyways.
But tell,
I'm on
tell,
Twitter now. That's what I'm
exactly.
Follow
yeah.
me on Twitter.
You'll never work again.
Never. No.
You'll never
Who
work
needs
again.
That stuff? I have half a million followers.
So they've got this. So he's Sasha's married to Masha.
Masha. Yeah. So it's Sasha, Masha, and Natasha. Natasha is their daughter. One character says, "Geez, these Russians have no imagination." You know? Sasha, Masha, Natasha, and Masha's a psychiatrist, which is very helpful in this book. Natasha goes by Nat, and she's sort of non-binary. She doesn't quite adhere to any gender at this point. She's only 7, 8 years old, I think, right? And then they invite their friends, and their friends are... one of their friends, Karen Cho, is a Korean-American. She developed an app that just sold for billions of dollars that makes people fall in love with each other. So you look at this thing, and you fall in love. It's sort of like the Midsummer Night Dream kind of effect in this book, where two people fall in love, but because of an algorithm, not because of a potion. And then you have Vinod Mehta, who is an Indian-American immigrant. And they all went to high school with Sasha. And he is sort of he's one of the nicer people I've ever written. He's a kind of failed writer. Now he's a short order cook for his uncle in Queens. And then you have D. Cameron. The Cameron, get it? D. That's the level of humor we're at. D. Cameron, who's this fiery essay writer, and she's of the left, but she sometimes flirts with the far right to get more attention. That's happened to a bunch of friends of mine.
Yeah, you know, that happens all the time.
They have the horseshoe effect when you go either too far left or right and you end up in the other place.
Yeah, no, we have actually, there's a few of them here in Tokyo this afternoon.
Oh, really? I'd love
yeah,
to meet
yeah,
them.
Yeah, yeah, they were the anti-vaxxer crowd.
Oh, right.
Some of whom I know for many years as being members of the Socialist Workers Party. They're now, woo, gone the other way.
I love it. Now they're, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good.
That's nice to know that it happens on this side of the world.
It happens on this side of the world, yeah.
Great,
yeah.
Great. Who else did I leave anyone? Oh, and then there's the actor.
Yeah.
Who is just called the actor almost throughout the whole book. And he is so hot that you should buy this book just for the actor. Just for descriptions of him in various stages of nudity. Incredible. And he's based, I've done a lot of work in LA or whatever you want to call it, Hollywood, and have met my share of actors. And I guess everyone just always tries to figure out who it is. If you Google me and some actors, you'll get an idea of all the people I've mashed together to create this.
Give us an inclination.
I can't. Because of libel laws. I mean, we all saw what just happened to us.
It's okay. Nobody knows.
Adam, what's her name? Amanda Heard, is it? Yeah. I did work with, he's not the main element for this, but I've done a lot of stuff with James Franco, who was a student of mine at Columbia. He studied writing. He studied 10 different disciplines at once, writing, reading, arithmetic, and pottery, I believe. But he's great. And so, but it is interesting. I mean, in America, obviously, like here, we don't have a royalty, unlike the people across the thing. We don't have royalty, but we have celebrity, and that's kind of who steps in for our the people that we endlessly admire for no good reason whatsoever. You know?
And tell us, so but the book is, I mean, yeah, it's these characters, but in the background, there's the local yokels, the hillbillies, who are not that fond of the immigrants. So what you're writing about is contemporary America.
Yeah, in a sense, because we do live, where we live now, it's become incredibly popular. I mean, literally, I'm living on this dirt road with people who can't afford tires for their trucks, so they put their trucks on blocks, but their license plate next to their Trump sign says, taxes too high, you know, because they're paying a lot of taxes. But even amongst these dirt roads, they just built $3.5 million developments, down the street. So it makes no sense, but all these New Yorkers are fleeing now. The pandemic made them realize they can work off of out of Manhattan, and the land was cheap, but not isn't anymore. But there's obviously all this friction. So like Senderovsky, well, a little bit unlike Senderovsky, what I do is a lot of lightning hits many times. Ooh, I'm up. All right. Okay, that's fine.
There you go, a lot of lightning hits.
Lightning hits, that's good. So thank you for the sound effect. Many trees are knocked down on my property all the time, and I give it to the people so that they don't kill me. So because many of them can't afford heating during the winter.
So these are people in upstate New York are in such poverty that they're this is actually...
People say, you know, north of Westchester, you're in Alabama. No, it's incredible. And the same going west toward Pennsylvania. Yeah, there's a lot of poverty up there. Yeah, and ours isn't even the worst for it. But it's interesting because they are the wealthy second homeowners, and this is one of the themes of the book. The wealthy second homeowners are all, some Democrats and are very left. It's the poor people who are of the right. So. There was a lot of friction. And one incident that really did happen to me, there was a lot of anti-Asian sentiment, especially when Trump started talking about the China flu, the Wuhan virus, all that stuff. And my wife and kid are well, my kid's half Asian, my wife's Asian, and there was a truck that went right past them as they were walking on the road, which is in the book. Yeah, there was this moment where, I mean, he was just looking at them and just gunning his engine, you know.
Does your wife feel threatened in the States?
Yeah, but I think Asian Americans, and many of these characters are Korean and Indian, I think many of my Asian friends are very threatened, and even in New York and San Francisco, because these acts of violence have taken place there too. So Trump sort of lit the match, but there's been a general fire. So I guess, yeah, in a sense, the book is, there's a passage in this book where all of these kids who are all, kids, sorry, 50-year-old kids, who are talking about how their parents brought them here when they were very young, and they brought them here for safety, but that they no longer feel safe here. And it's almost a question of, well, where do we go next if the safety runs out? And this was during the time of Trump, written during the time of Trump, set during the time of Trump, where there wasn't any sense of safety in terms of policy of dealing with COVID, but there was also constant conflagrations of racial animus fed by the person in the White House. So all of that, I'm sorry, it is a funny book, I swear.
No, it is.
Well, I'm sorry, are the Asians getting killed? That's what I'm reading? It's impossible not to talk about that.
On that issue, I read an interview with you not that long ago. You just said, you have to write funny. Speaking of funny, you said you can't write any other way.
Yeah, I can't. And you know, it's interesting. I teach a class at Columbia now called, So You Wanna Write Funny? ? And people love, I mean, it's a huge, it's like, you know, there's a waiting list for it because people feel that literature, and we teach literary fiction, with a capital L and F up there, but people do feel like that those of us that are, in a sense, performative or want to entertain, God forbid, entertain the reader, that we're sort of being a little elbowed out of the church of literary fiction and being sent, you know. Because I think it's even harder to write funny stuff.
It's really hard.
I think, to me, funny is serious because you have to do both things. Because if a book is just funny, then you haven't accomplished anything. But you have to create this kind of, I always use a Cold War metaphor, the intercontinental ballistic missile. You know, the humor is the missile, but the payload, the nuclear payload, is the tragedy. So you're using humor to communicate a tragedy. At the end of this book, obviously, there's a tragedy. In the end of everything I write, there's a tragedy because, you know, I believe in tragedy. But comedy is the way for me to get that across.
And, you know, when I look at your stuff, years ago, the first book I picked up was Absurdistan. Mm. And Absurdistan is about this, again, Russian migrant living in some obscure republic south of Russia.
So Georgia, Azerbaijan, yeah. Yeah, you know, and he's a 400-pound son of Russian oligarchs. Yeah, back then I think my humor was a little broader, perhaps, because I think when you're in your 20s, you're just an angry young person. Not Sally Rooney, of course, who's wonderful, but the people like myself, very angry and fulminating, and so the satire needs to be bigger and sharper, and so that's, you know, that was, I think, the idea behind that. But I think becoming a father has softened me considerably, you know, because now I can't just hate people as much, because having a kid, I never thought I'd have one. Russians don't breed in captivity at all, but I did, and, you know, and having him has been very nice in the sense that it has really sharpened my empathy muscles, or not sharpened, I don't know, exercised. English, second language, for sure. How do you say it makes big man bigger? So it definitely did that. And I'll give you an example. There's another character here named Ed, and Ed is the son of a Korean chaebol owners. Chaebols are like Samsung or LG, giant conglomerates. And he is based on a couple of people I know from Korea and other places. And I knew this one guy, and whenever he would talk to a woman that he really liked, he would put his hand on his ear like this, you know, and be like, hi, you know. And we'd be like, what are you calling Sputnik with that thing, you know? We always made fun of him. And Ed does that in the book with Dee. He's in love with Dee. But as he does it, he starts thinking. If I was writing back in the Absurdistan days, I would just make fun of him and move along.
Yeah.
But now I kind of go into his consciousness, and he's thinking, oh, God, I'm doing it again, aren't I? Why do I have to keep doing this? Why can't I take my freaking hand off my ear? And I think that's the sort of, that's the next step is but in my dotage.
In your dotage.
Yeah, I'm able to.
But it's funny because all the stuff I've read, like, for example, if you take Lake Success, which is the last one, it's a kind of a hedge fund manager who goes off the rails, who travels around the States in a Greyhound bus, whose wife then goes has an affair, all sorts of, there is this constant referral to this, the sort of, the strivingness, the yearning of America.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, every immigrant gets this. Every immigrant child gets, you know, we brought you here for a reason. You have to succeed. You know, there's no failure. I mean, the school I went to, Stuyvesant High School, which is 3,000 immigrants shoved into a very small, now they have a bigger school, but back then it was tiny. I actually lived down the street from the old one. And, you know, 50 people in a class, and it was a zoo. People sabotaging each other's scientific experiments to win a prize. No,
it's like Gonzaga.
It's like a what?
Gonzaga. It's a school in Dublin.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's the same shit.
You have the same shit here?
Only in that particular school.
You have everything here exactly the same.
We've, you know, we got everything here in a tiny microcosm. What fascinates a lot of us about America is that we have, where you have the general, which allows you a canvas to write about it, which is easily recognizable. We have the microscopic version of Stuyvesant High School.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
You know,
12 people.
You know, yeah, exactly.
Oh, you know who taught at Stuyvesant? But he left the day I got there. It was Frank McCourt.
He taught. He just saw the writing on the wall.
He saw the writing on the wall. He's like, oh, the new sheriff's in town. No. And weirdly enough, I live in the building where he lived until his books became so successful that he just moved to Connecticut. So there's this weird kind
Frank
of
McCourt thing
Frank
going
McCourt
on.
Thing going on. It's
so
scary.
When are you going to write the Leningrad version of Angelus Ashes?
Yeah,
you're going to go back to, you know, Mrs. Granny Steingarten. But do you ever feel like going back there?
I used to go back all the time.
No, in your work.
You mean to?
Go back to Russia and write about it.
Well, I'm not allowed into Russia. I was banned from Russia in 2015. I tried to go, and they said your visa is no longer accepted here.
What? Did they give any reason?
They said reapply, you know. So I've been going to Ukraine since because I'm quite welcome there. I go on TV. I yell a lot. It's good. And I think the next book I want to write will be partly about that, about the fact that, you know, the language that I grew up with is now being used in the service of fascism. And, you know, it's if you were growing up in the 20s and 30s and you spoke German, it didn't matter where you lived, you had to have a reckoning with what that language and the culture that you grew up with, what it connotes now that we see the you know, the savagery of what's happening. So I think, but again, I'll try to make it funny, but I want to entertain the reader as well, but some of this stuff has been very, very depressing.
And when you talk to your friends back there, do you still have lots of mates back there?
Yeah, I do.
And are they leaving? Are they staying? Are they...
They all said, I mean, on the 24th, I had all these texts, and they all said the same thing, «Мне позорно», I am ashamed. You know, I am ashamed. And then you get to the nitty-gritty of what they can do. And many of them, because they're my age, have elderly parents. And there's no real social safety net or anything. You have to take care of your parents, so it's very hard for them to leave without, and nobody's going to take their parents, too, you know.
Yeah.
So it's very hard for them. Some are leaving. Many of them are just, you know, middle-class people. They don't have the Dubai connections of the elites, and at the same time, they're not dissidents, so they wouldn't get, you know, citizenship in Germany or Latvia or something. So it's very...
They're stuck.
And they're stuck in this world where... And many of them, by the way, are not ethnically Russian. One of my friends is half Ukrainian by ethnicity. His wife is from Sakha, which is the Yakut Republic. Mm-hmm. So she's, you know, she has Asian features. And it's... They don't know what to do.
But isn't this one of the odd things about Russia is that it is really mixed. I mean, the Soviet Union was a mixed up place.
It wasn't mixed.
And the Russians are now mixed.
No. Well, if you look at my own heritage, two grandparents, Ukraine, were born in Ukraine, one in Belarus and one in Russia proper. And that one was Russian Christian. And in fact, he was the son of a deacon, which is historically the drunkest member of the Russian church, which says a lot by many standards.
There's a vacancy here.
There's a vacancy. Oh, that's right. I saw that.
Yeah. There's a job application. There's a job to expect.
New Testament is one of my two favorite testaments. good stuff.
And tell us, you know, when you're writing it for, I mean, when you're writing this stuff, but you're also writing journalism.
No.
You're now starting a Substack.
Yeah, today they asked me to do a Substack. They're giving me money. It's hard to say no. So, do you know what a Substack is? Good, good. Keep it that way. It's terrible. No, it's fine. It's like your own journal. It's like basically keeping a diary, but it's completely public. So if you want to read about all my problems, you know, you can give me $10 a month. And yeah, this is the late stage capitalism run amok.
Exactly.
Yeah. They don't have it here. They must have it here. No.
No. It's not as evolved, but it's definitely a thing in the States.
Oh yeah.
Definitely.
Everyone I know has a Substack.
But
Rushdie, my friend Rushdie, has a Substack, and he's got a gazillion subscribers.
They always say that.
Yeah.
Oh no, it says at the end. It's like a YouTube thing.
Yeah.
It's like you can't pretend.
Yeah.
But can I ask you about screenwriting?
Yeah, I love screenwriting.
Yeah, I know you.
So easy. Sorry. Compared to this, you know, because. Screenwriting. You have to conjure in a new way, completely new way. You have to conjure what it's like to, I don't know, enter a Protestant church in Dalkey, and you have to describe this and that and the other thing. Screenwriting, you know, interior church day, and there you go. You're off in the races. And I love writing dialogue, which when I teach at Columbia, that's one of the things that I find is that a lot of young people just, I guess it's because of their textual connection. The dialogue never sounds like what people talk to each other. It sounds like writers think people talk like, you know. So I actually tell them, look at The Sopranos or Screenplay or The Wire or any of the great, or Succession was a show which I worked on,
Jesus, which where the writing room is actually based in London.
And
awesome.
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? Succession, you think it's about these American plutocrats, but almost the entire staff is British. So it's that British class humor.
The way your mouth says fuck off is very British.
Fuck off is very British.
Yeah, yeah, no, it is.
Like, fuck off is the basic building block of Succession.
It,
you
know? Is,
yeah.
It is.
Yeah,
it
that's
is.
It. Fuck off.
So what
fuck
were you
off,
doing in Succession?
After Lake Success, because I have become sort of the you know, the billionaire whisperer. I have all these billionaire friends because I interviewed them for Lake Success for this Hespin thing. So they just wanted to have me help them plot out the second season with all the shenanigans that the rich are up to. And then the rich people were very, even though the show makes them look horrible, all the rich people I know were so happy about it, except for one woman who I was sitting there and she said, I don't like that show you do because you make fun of my family.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out she's a Murdoch.
Now, like, let's explore this a bit more.
Yeah, I'm like slowly backing away. This other billionaire just flew me down to Uruguay on his jet, and then he had this thing.
I'm going to hang with you.
Come along. Yeah. So we get off the jet, and there's a helicopter waiting for each of us to fly to the yacht. And as we're flying, in Succession, they always have that scene of the helicopters flying.
They have the two of them always.
They always have two. So as our string of helicopters are flying, they start piping in the Succession theme song.
And tell me, so you were writing Succession for the last couple of years?
No, just season
just,
two.
Just season two.
No, yeah. I wish I had more time to do that show, but I'm trying to. They're always buying my books and trying to make stuff out of them, and then in the end, it's like doesn't really make any sense.
Do you have any?
Yeah, I work on them too.
But like, so when you sell the rights,
yeah.
What's the process?
There's a writing room that gets together. Basically, we drink a lot, and then sort of lob ideas. There's a big whiteboard. So, you know, episode 3, the Steingart character, you know, has an affair or something. And then all these ideas go around. Not that I'm the character, I'm good. But all that stuff happens. So it's interesting. It's like sort of dissecting your life into little slices. It's fun.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And let me go back to this celebrity culture in the States, because it is sort of completely outsized here. And the actor in this book is a classic example of unbelievable vanity, all that stuff. You know, when you're sitting down to write and you're writing about this type of person, what's going on in your head?
Well, sometimes you leave a meeting with one of them and there's just so much great dialogue because they have a lot of people have no conception of who they are and how they sound. So they often, you know, that I wrote that absurd stand about this 300-pound Russian son of Russian oligarchs. That was based on this person. And he, you know, and I saw him running after me on the streets of New York. Well, slowly moving after me on the streets of New York. And I was like, oh, shit, he's going to kill me, you know. But he caught up with me many weeks later, and he said, I loved Absurdistan. Who's that schmuck Misha? You know. So I feel that people, and maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe somebody will write about me one day and I won't recognize who I am either. So, yeah, it's definitely strange. But, yeah, oh, the actor, yeah, right. So they would, you know, get into these, he would say, you know, I believe that I am Ulysses. And I'm like, what? He'd say, yes. And then he would quote something from, not James Joyce.
But the original one, yeah?
Yes, the good stuff, the original good stuff. And then he would say, what was the fight about? Oh, he would say, you don't understand subtext, Gary. And I'd say, but I teach a course on subtext at Columbia. And all that made it into the book, obviously, because it's just too precious, you know.
Gary, when you're looking for dialogue, when you're looking for characters, are you sitting down? Are you taking notes? Are you all ears? When you're sitting in a bar, because I'm always intrigued, because the dialogue is extraordinary, and the characters, they're American characters, but anybody who lives in the West can figure these out. Yeah. I mean, are you constantly all ears?
Absolutely. You know, it's like you're a doctor. You're always on call. You're always, you know, I keep fanatical amounts of notes.
Yeah, this is what I want to talk to you about.
Absolutely. And, you know, I hate technology, but the iPhone is very good at this because you're sitting at a bar and some schmuck is saying something and, you know, instead of writing it down, you're like, it looks like you're texting or something, but what you're really doing is you're just taking down the dialogue completely. It's beautiful. It's really great. No, I love, there's a very journalistic approach I think I take to writing fiction. So when I wrote Lake Success, guy travels across the country, across America on a Greyhound bus. Guess what I did? I traveled across America on a Greyhound bus, almost killed me. There's a lot of decapitations that happen on Greyhounds. I don't know why, but we've had a couple in the last year or so. People just chopping each other's heads off with machetes. God, I love my country. It's just, the fun never stops. It's like, oh yeah, we're doing that now, right? Well, great. So, and when I researched Absurdistan, I hung out with gigantic Russian
mafioso.
Yeah. Exactly. So now in the book I'm writing now, one of the characters is a 20-something journalist. Just starting out, having a lot of problems with her career. So I'm hanging out with all these 20-something journalists who have a lot of problems with their careers and just taking notes, you know. And I said, one of them is throwing a party, and I said, can I come? She's like, sure. So just going to be sitting there. So it is very much, Tom Wolfe, I guess, used to do stuff like that.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, you know, but there is a sort of a Tom Wolfe, except it's that idea of looking at American society and finding the little self-evident cracks that everybody identifies. And also, the political background is always very important. I mean, Lake Success and this are Trump novels.
No, they are. I mean, look, we're in a state of deep decline right now. And as someone who grew up in the Soviet Union, I know what deep decline on a superpower level looks like. And it's always intrigued me. How that country collapsed is fascinating. And I'm not saying America's collapsing yet, but it ain't going up, you know.
Yeah.
And watching the January 6th hearings, it's just, it's unimaginable. I mean, you know, I've written dystopian fiction. Supersad True Love Story is my dystopian novel. And I mean, there's stuff like that there, but that was written like 12 years
ago.
It's a long time ago. And I was thinking, well, if this happens, it'll happen 50, 60 years from now. But here we are, you know.
And this is when there's a, from Supersad, I remember, was, there was the bipartisan party.
The bipartisan party, which... Yeah, given that the Democrats can't govern even when we own...
But this is what... Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
We and do you get a sense of that, like the American decline as a as an almost a monthly expression of American culture?
No. It's interesting because, you know, we have obviously a Democratic president, but it almost doesn't make any difference. We're now a minority-led country. The majority has no say. A lot of it has to do with the way the electoral, what Homer Simpson called the electrical college. the way the electrical college is set up obviously has a lot to do with that. The fact that rural people and people in rural states have more sway than those of us who live in partly in upstate and partly in Manhattan. And it's very sad because and one thing that my parents did right, they did so much wrong, but they got me out of Russia
at
the right time. Yeah, well, we can have a separate symposium on that. but they got me out of Russia, you know, at the right time. And that's something that I've pledged to do for my own son now that I have a kid. And so, you know.
What did you say?
He's 8, so okay. Prime time to
that's move. That's something about the same time.
Deposit
him in Rome and see where he goes.
Well, yeah, that would be funny. Yeah, he end up in Rome and then choose a country to go to.
But can I go on? You were going to say what your parents was to get you out at that time.
Yeah, they had the presence of mind, even though they had relative parents who were very sick. My mother did. They had the presence of mind to sacrifice culture, language, all that stuff to get me out. And you know, I mean, if I move somewhere, I could always write and do stuff, but they came without any of that stuff. They came with, you know, the proverbial American $100 in their pocket or whatever it was, and some very weird Romanian furniture they dragged across the ocean. Absolutely shocking looking stuff. But that was it, you know. So I would. And my wife and I talk about this all the time. You know,
where do we go? Korean.
Korean-American, born in California. But we always talk about, you know, what next if, you know, things continue to deteriorate.
So, Turkey?
We came here for the festival in 2019, my whole family, and they really liked it. And they like Dublin quite a bit. So, yeah, it's high on our list. I mean, it does get warmer than this, right?
No.
In the summer? Because that's the only thing that I'm not 100%
cool with. This is kind of as good as it gets,
Boy. Okay.
It's all not going to get much hotter.
Right. Well, global warming can help us out here.
Yeah. Now we've been urging it for years, this global warming shit. It just hasn't impacted it. And it's funny, when you run a festival, all you do the last week in Ireland. Like I was just thinking the other day, if you're running a festival in France, for example, it's middle of June, you don't know that Norwegian weather forecasting is better than German.
Mm-hmm.
But if you run a festival in Ireland, you know what's the most exacting weather forecast service in the whole of Europe, and it's Norwegian.
Norwegian?
Norwegian, just if you know, okay? It's called Y-O-R-N-O. Y-O-R-N-O. No, but the point is, because, you know, if you're doing a festival in a normal country, don't worry about the fact that you might get an Arctic chill in the middle of June. But that's what you do here. But no, but to come back to your idea, but I mean, on a more serious level, that you think the United States is sufficiently going the wrong direction for you to think, maybe.
Yeah, because it has a lot of the elements that are necessary for democracy to collapse. You have a very large percentage of population that does not believe in the truth. They have their own ecosystem that sprouts lies, the same kind of ecosystem that existed under the fascists in Nazi Germany. They're also armed to the teeth. Even in our country, friends, and also in that little house we have upstate, you hear gunfire all the time. People are just shooting anything. You know, I mean, I would love to kill the groundhog that keeps eating my Christmas trees, but other than that, I'm not going to pick up arms. But, you know, there's all these Second Amendment bumper stickers, the right to arm bears, whatever the hell, you know. And so, you know, and we saw this in January 6th. There's an element that has access to guns, is also many of these people are trained in the military. And this scenario was, you know, if you look at The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, that's definitely part of the scenario, is that there was an armed group that also is aligned with certain religious views, which are evangelical but are really white nationalist with a religious aspect to them. You know, the religion is the fig leaf over this idea of white nationalism. So, yeah, fun stuff. And just, every time you turn on the news, you know, almost Ukraine was horrible, but at least it united the country in a weird way for at least a little bit. Even upstate, people will have Ukrainian flags next to their, you know, Trump or whatever flags. And that was a one good moment of unity. But now it's on to the next thing.
But when you look at things like, you know, the abortion legislation now, gun crime, I mean, lots of books have been written in the last 12 months. Well, not lots, a couple of books, bestsellers, the conditions for, I mean, it sounds bizarre, but like civil war within the United States.
Sure, of course.
Do you feel that? Really?
Of course. We feel that it was almost tested, wasn't it? You know, that today we found out that Mike Pence was 40 feet away from the people who were armed and ready to kill him. They were sent there with a mission to kill him, elements of the Proud Boys. We had a president who was basically telling them to kill them in so many words. This is not a ripe condition for a democracy to continue unless these things are hugely addressed and people are put in prison and arrested. And that's not what's happening. You know, if you have an 8-year-old child in an American school, you are thinking, and that child is going through drills about what will happen when the next person armed with the machine gun comes out, with an assault rifle comes out, you know. So that's part of his upbringing already, this idea, even though New York, obviously, knock on whatever the hell this is, you know, doesn't see the same kind of attacks that happen in other parts of America yet. But still, you know, there's this danger that your child will die of gunfire, you know. So all that is not, these are not great preconditions for democracy. And it's depressing because I do love America very much. And I think all my books have a love of America. I love upstate. I love how beautiful the country is. Ireland, of course, is a beautiful country, but there's something to be said for even getting on a Greyhound bus, as I did, which is not the best mode of transportation. But, you know, you wake up, you look out, all of a sudden you're in Arizona and you might as well be on another planet. Things look like a different landscape, a different universe. All that is beautiful. And the fact that, yes, that all these people, and I know Ireland has 19% of the Irish are now foreign-born, which is great. Keep it up. Maybe take me with you. but, you know, the fact that we were kind of an original melting pot, despite all the grievous things that we've done to African and Native Americans, all of that is very important to me. You know, that's why I've loved that country for so long. That's why I continue to write about that country and not about Russia. So this would be, it would be tragic. I do want my son to grow up, you know, an American. Yeah. An American with Korean, Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian heritage, but an American nonetheless.
And just before we go, you know, your many reviews say, you know, the finest political satirist writing, the finest satirist writing. What does a satirist when faced with a country like that?
That's the thing. Maybe that's why I went full on Chekhovian with this thing, right? Because the satire.
How do you mean full on Chekhovian?
Well, I mean, exactly. So all my favorite Chekhov plays and short stories, it's all the same thing. People get together in the country and they have regrets together, you know, and then maybe they take a bath together or something. And there is a very sexy bath scene in there that I cannot recommend highly enough. You will never look at the shower head the same way again. But, you know, there is definitely that Chekhovian element. The countryside, everything is quiet. The book is much slower paced than my usual work. But I am usually labeled a satirist, and I don't know, it's fine if they say something, if they put best.
Best is always good.
Best is
best
always
we like.
Good.
Best
yeah,
we like.
Yeah,
as long not as, better than worse.
If the Irish Times is happy, Jewish eyes are smiling, you know.
No, but I mean, do you feel pressure to come up with, you know, when the world is going so seriously wrong, is the satirist's urge? What's the urge?
How do you top, for example, the Trump years? How, as a satirist, do you? The man's telling us to inject bleach to cure ourselves from COVID, and to go into the sun. The sun will get the COVID out. That's the president of the United States is saying that. There's a brilliant movie called Idiocracy. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Amazing movie, you know. And when it came out 10, 15, 20 years ago, Mike Judd is the director. You know, it seemed like a funny, far-fetched thing. No, now it's history. This is where we live in.
I think on that note, we are almost out of time. Gary Steingart, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.